the great civilizations all had cultures which had virtues that, lo and behold, were similar. And so similar, in fact, like you had Bushido as a concept in Japan that was almost identical to chivalry as a concept in Europe, which, funny enough, came about at the exact same time in completely disconnected cultures. The Japanese had no contact with the West had no contact with Japan, and they literally had the same virtues. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fan, not for the gram, stunt me, destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on another brilliant guest. He is an author and an entrepreneur, and this is Alexander Svetsky. Welcome to the show.
Zuby, good to see you again, brother.
No doubt, Alex. How's everything going?
Good, man. I have been, it's been, what, almost 2 years since we last saw each other, actually. It was at my wedding, right?
Like, it was at your wedding. Yeah,
in Austin. That was the last time. Yeah, man, it's been crazy. It's been a whirlwind, man. 2023 was a bit of a crazy year for me trying to recalibrate what the hell I'm doing with my life and all this sort of stuff. But this year has been one of, I don't want to sound like cocky or, like, you know, to say winning, but it's been the rough patch. 2022 and 2023 has officially, I've rounded that corner, and it's been a fantastic year, man. So lots to discuss on that.
Awesome, man. Well, I'm very happy to hear that. So first things first, actually, how has married life been?
Amazing. Amazing. I mean, when I was young, and I think, I don't know if you can relate to this or not, but probably people listening to this is, you know, you fall into these traps of trying to date as many women and chasing this and doing that. And you think you're cool because you're spinning so many plates and all that kind of crap. But, you know, you get to a point where it's time to mature, time to grow up, time to stop basically being a teenager. And yeah, marriage has been a blessing in that sense. And you've met my wife. She's a beautiful woman. And it's been incredible. Like, you instead of going broad and wide, you go deep, and it's a different thing, and it's a beautiful thing. And I think I noticed as well, you are engaged as well, or on the way to getting married, or
I think it's on the way. Not engaged yet, but yeah. Awesome, man. Well, Alex, I know who you are, but for my listeners who are not familiar with you and your work, please give them a little bit of an intro.
Yeah, sure. So most people know me from my writing. And in fact, the last time you and I did a show together was with Mark Moss when we published the Uncommunist Manifesto. That was back in 2022. And my life has primarily been a mixture of writing and building. And I would say, though, that the building, and what I mean by building is like building businesses, building companies, entrepreneurialism, all of that sort of stuff. That probably goes back a lot further. So I went to university. I studied as a civil engineer. I took my scholarship money and put it on the stock market instead. There's a really funny episode of me and Sean Puri on My First Million. I think I was episode number 7 with him back in the day. And the whole story is there. It's hilarious. But basically, I put my scholarship money on the stock market, 10x'd my money, thought I was a genius. I got my spreadsheet out, projected forward. I was like, I'm going to be a billionaire by the time I'm 28. This is it. I figured it out. Warren Buffett, watch out, dude. And by the time I turned 20 and a half, 21, I was about $250,000 in debt. So I had the car in reverse, not in first gear, went backwards. And that kind of put me on a path to go out and figure out how to dig myself out of the hole. And I never had a job. I just went and straight up did door-to-door sales. And one thing led to the other. I started building businesses. I built everything from gyms to cafes to Jesus Christ, what else did I do? Sales companies, renewable energy. I was in that game. Like, I did all sorts of things, and some things were really successful. Some things blew up. I got into software around 2014 and then found my way into Bitcoin 2016, 2017, where I launched the world's first like Bitcoin savings app. So these days they're everywhere, like Swan. And I think in the MENA region, there's Rain, there's Relay, there's all this sort of stuff. But we were the first one, called Amber in Australia. And that's really where I found my groove. But 2021, I left that, had a bit of a dispute with the Australian government, regulators, all this sort of stuff. And I think primarily that was because I was a loud voice against the COVID stuff. I got debanked, all sorts of crazy stuff happened. And yeah, that sort of gave me an opportunity to lean more into writing. And then over the last year and a bit, I've found my way back into building something else, which is involved in sort of the network state area. And if we got some time later, we can discuss that. But yeah, the last couple of years have primarily been writing, researching. We're going to discuss that, I guess, with the Bushido of Bitcoin, which is the latest book that I wrote. And yeah, just building again. So that's really my background. If I had to sum it up, writing and building, they're the two things, because as much as we had our fun in 2020, 2021, 2022 laughing at Clown World, I think it's time we start the new chapter, right? Is like actually, you know, build something new if we don't like Clown World.
Yeah, for sure, man. Well, we're at a very pivotal place in humanity, as far as I'm concerned. I get the sense that you have that same feeling. You know, we're in the first quarter, towards the end of the first quarter of a new century. Mm-hmm. And last century was a horribly crazy one in many ways. Lots of advancements, but lots of violence and brutality and death and destruction. And I would certainly like to think that this century is going to be a better one, but I think we're very much at a precipice where the choice ultimately comes down to the people. And I think maybe you share the sentiment. I believe that the people always ultimately hold the power and always have. And I think the fundamental problem is most people do not realize that. And so there's this sort of constant battle, I don't know, between unconsciousness and consciousness. And there's always going to be more followers than there are leaders. And there's always going to be more, you know, fewer critical thinkers than there are people who will just go with the flow and go wherever the majority goes. And as long as the majority is going in an okay direction, then I guess that works. But as we've seen in the last few years and many, many times in history, when the majority is going in a dangerous direction, then, you know, people just kind of get swept along with it. And it's very hard to change the tide.
Well, this is, you said something there, which might be a slight contradiction, and I'd like to tease it out and clarify it a little bit. So you said the people have the power, and power is an interesting thing. We've been conditioned, and I believe this is a modern psyop, is we've been conditioned to think that power is evil, that power corrupts, that power, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and all this sort of stuff. And I've come to believe that is a psyop, because power is like technology; it's agnostic. It exists. And in fact, it's almost like you think about what power actually is. It's the capacity to channel energy. It's energy over time. The actual, the equation, the physical equation is that. And by abdicating the responsibility to channel power, what you do is you leave a vacuum for parasites, for people or things that want power for power's sake, not as a means to an end, but as the end, to go and attain it. And therefore, I think it's incumbent on... So let me add one more thing to this. Power is almost like the initiating force. It is the thing that comes first. And it, you know, if I use an arrow as an analogy here, it's the thing that shoots the arrow. And the people are more like the arrow, they're the inertia. So it's not that the power is always with the people, it's that the power actually is with leadership. And if leadership is guiding the people, the inertia, in the wrong direction, like off the side of a cliff, as we've seen particularly, you know, recently with American politics and basically politics all over the world, is the masses, the people who have the inertia power, which is a different kind of power. It's kind of like undirected, so it must be directed. They will literally march right off a cliff and not even bat an eyelid. Whereas if there is strong leadership, and where you're living now in Dubai is a great example of that. Bukele is a great example of that. You know, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, these people were great examples of that. Is if you can have a person who sees power as a responsibility and a means to an end, and that end may be more life, greater civilization, beauty, ascendance, that sort of stuff, they can channel that power in that direction, and then they can guide the inertial mass, the inertial power of the people in that direction. I think that's a really, really important distinction, because what's happened with the world, in particular over the last century, is this leftist paradigm that no, power is evil, power with the people, all this sort of stuff, which doesn't really do anything. It creates this like homogenous blob of people that are susceptible to whatever. And otherwise virtuous people, otherwise strong people who had the capacity to channel power, they're like, no, you know what? I don't want to be evil. I don't want to be bad. I don't want to be corrupted. So I'll stay away from positions of power. They opt out. They leave a vacuum. The parasites come in. They foment all sorts of crazy stupidity. And then the world basically falls apart. So I think that's just the important thing for people to dig into.
I'm not of the belief that power is evil. I mean, I believe in God, and I believe that God is the ultimate power, and I believe that God is the ultimate good. So power inherently is power is neutral. Power is neutral in the same way I would say that money is neutral. Mm-hmm. It can be an amplifier. It's something that's there. I would say it's a form of energy. And I would say that I know it normally is thought of in the physics sense, but energy cannot be created or destroyed. And I think the same is true of power. It's going to lie somewhere. It's going to lie somewhere between a combination of individuals, institutions, the state, companies, organizations, depending on what the situation is. And the more that individuals abdicate responsibility, then the more the state apparatus grows, right? The more that that power has to go somewhere. So I think we agree there. We're just kind of speaking in slightly different language. The power is always there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I actually wanted to come to this point because you talk in your book, The Bushido of Bitcoin, about rights and responsibilities. And this is a point I've made many times, especially on stages in some of the speeches I've given around the world. I think because of the time we lived through, particularly from, say, 2020 to 2022, we had to talk a lot about rights because rights were being trampled. Basic liberties and freedoms were being completely trampled. And so there was a lot of talk about rights, but I always say to people that, of course, rights have to be balanced with responsibilities, and with every right comes a relevant responsibility. So I know you talk about this a little bit in the book, so I wanted to kind of go into that topic of rights, responsibilities, and how these two things interact.
Yeah, it's like a ledger, basically, right? Like accounting. There's a debit and there's a credit, right? So if you go and claim a right to something, the question immediately is, okay, well, who is going to enforce that right? Whose responsibility is it? Like if you've got a right to a house, this is a classic example, who's going to build it? Like me, you, like who has to do the thing that results in the outcome of your right? And this is something, once again, that the modern left completely ignores, and the modern states actually completely ignore. They live and feed off the capital that existed beforehand, right, of people who better understood this idea of responsibility. Like if you want a right of some sort, you need to build the capital base, and you need to take on the responsibility to build on the capital base to produce that right in some way, shape, or form. If we're speaking economically, if you're speaking politically, if you want private property rights, for example, you need to enforce private property somehow. Otherwise, there's no right there. Like it's and this is where a lot of the libertarians kind of drive me crazy sometimes. And the last time we spoke, when we were doing the Uncommunist Manifesto, I was still, I guess, the phase of my life where I was a little bit conservative, but I was a raging libertarian Austrian economist and all that sort of stuff. And I was still very much within that paradigm. But I've come to mature a little bit to understand that there's something that underlies all of this, and that is the responsibility to enforce these things. And sometimes, and I guess this is a Jordan Peterson-esque thing, is that the capacity to enforce a right implies the capacity to also be violent or dangerous. Like if you are weak, if you do not have the capacity to enforce the right, we're animals, man. We can smell that. We can sense weakness. This is what criminals also feed on, right? They see people who cannot defend themselves, and they're the ones they attack. This is why a lion goes after the weakest gazelle in the herd. So we can't just sit there and say, oh, well, that's unfair and that's not right and all this sort of stuff. No. We need to build ourselves in such a way that we can enforce the right when needed. You know, the threat of violence must exist. The threat of enforcement must exist in order for us to establish that right, to establish that border. And that means the responsibility is on us to claim and establish those rights. So I think that's, I guess, a political lens on that question. I'm happy to dive into a couple other elements of that.
We all know that in today's fast-paced world, it's harder than ever to live a healthy lifestyle. Just about everyone is struggling with gut issues, stress, inflammation, fatigue, or immune issues. Most of it comes down to diet, but getting nutrient-rich food consistently isn't always easy or affordable. With hectic schedules, processed foods, and the rising cost of healthy options, we all need a cheat code as the game of life gets more difficult. My cheat code is Optimal Human. With over 90 ingredients, including powerful vitamins and other nutrients, one serving of Optimal Human helps me fulfill my daily nutritional needs. And in my opinion, it tastes better than many of the other green supplements on the market. Optimal Human contains powerful superfoods like organic reishi mushroom for your brain, turmeric root for your joints, beetroot for cardiovascular health, CoQ10 for cellular health, and probiotics for gut health. It's simple to integrate into your daily life. Just add one scoop to water, a smoothie, or your protein shake and get an instant, delicious nutrient boost. Try Optimal Human today and get 50% off your first month by going to optimalhuman.com/Zuby. That's optimalhuman.com/Zuby, and you'll get 50% off your first month. Go check it out. I'm curious as to, in the last couple of years, what would you say has made you shift from the more libertarian or maybe even anarchist perspective to maybe one that's more, I don't know if you'd call it more traditionally conservative in the true sense of the word. What do you think has caused that?
Honestly, life and history. Mm. if I had to sum it up, it's I was watching, actually not watching, I had a conversation with a wife's friend of mine, and she's, you know, typical Colorado chick, liberal, and I vote Democrat all the time and all this sort of stuff. And she's from Colombia. She emigrated there when she was really young, so she's American citizen, all this sort of stuff. And she said something interesting. She said, we were in Europe a couple of weeks back, or a month or two back, and she said, I think I'm going to vote for Trump for the first time. I was like, okay, interesting. And I said, why? She said, I'm sick and tired of these immigrants. She goes, I'm in Colorado, and there's people out there. It's like, she's like, they're washing my windows. I don't want them to wash my windows. She's like, I'm driving at the thing. She goes, there's all these people everywhere. She's like, it's driving me crazy. And something hit me. I was like, you know what? You can be as liberal in theory as you want, but when life catches up to you, you all of a sudden become conservative. And I don't know if you ever saw that clip that was going around where there was this like protest, people marching and talking about how like, oh, we need to let all the immigrants in no matter what. And some guy's out there and he's like pretending to be part of the State Department saying, look, we need to put these people somewhere. You know, do you have room in your house? And they're like, oh, no. Yeah, I don't have room in my house. You know what I mean? So it's like when it comes, like reality makes you conservative very, very quickly. Whereas, you know, the libertarian ideals and liberal ideals, all this sort of stuff, like they're all theoretic. In practice, these things don't work. So I think life in many ways, and then also looking at history, and I did a tweet a couple of weeks ago where I said all of those, basically I said history has been fundamentally right-wing or traditional conservative. The entire time. I said, you go back to these Roman ruins that we all talk about and that our civilization is effectively built on. Rome was a right-wing institution. You look at the beautiful Renaissance and medieval artwork and cathedrals and the Da Vinci's and all of this sort of stuff. That was like right-wing. Thank you very much. Like all of the great and beautiful things, whether it's artwork, whether it's sculptures, whether it's civilization, whether it's culture, whether it's cathedrals, all this sort of stuff, like a traditional conservative right wing. And it's important, like the word tradition here doesn't mean the past, it means that which does not pass. It's a very important distinction. And the more you look at that, the Alexander the Greats of the world, as I mentioned earlier, the Julius Caesars, the people who created great things, they were more like they had a maverick inside them, but they were always tethered to these principles, and call that the definition of conservatism, tethering to a principle. Yep. And they projected forward with that. So yeah, long way of answering your question. It's like life makes you that. And as you study history and you understand what is necessary for beauty, for greatness, for civilization, for legacy, for society, for strength, for life, for ascendance, for all of these things that we are aligned with, you need these kind of principles. You can't just be, mm-hmm. oh yeah, we're all equal. Well, no, fuck, that doesn't work, bro. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting, man. The podcast isn't even out yet as we recorded this, but I was recently on a really big podcast with Tom Bilyeu, the Impact Theory podcast. And if I remember correctly, I think the very first question he asked me was something about why I'm conservative or why I'm drawn to it. And I think the first thing that came out of my mouth was something like, well, it works, right? Like it's rooted in reality. We have thousands and thousands of years of human history to establish what works and what doesn't. We have examples of hundreds of different countries, thousands of different cities and villages and empires of all sorts of sizes. And when I think about conservatism, I don't mean it in the sort of simple Democrat, Republican, left-right thing. It's more of like just, okay, Lindy effect. What has worked for centuries or millennia? Why don't we maintain those things? Hey, marriage, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. It seems like every single functioning society all across the world, you know, people have tried all sorts of different things, and it seems like that's the best way to structure society and structure a family. So you know what? Maybe we should stick with that, and we shouldn't just blow it up and throw it out the window, right? What about, how about punishing crime? How about like having borders? How about like things which are now called quote unquote conservative, where I'm just like, it's common sense. It's just being rooted in reality and understanding human nature, both on an individual level and on a collective level. And if you understand that, you know, I have a belief that the vast majority of people in the world are conservative. When I say that, I don't even mean it in like a hard political sense. What I mean is most people have pretty conservative values. Most people want to get married and have a family and be in a safe environment. They think that people should get paid based on how much they create and how valuable they are. Most people have, it's funny. This relates to your previous book. I had a conversation with actually someone who I've known for decades, somebody who I went to school with back when I lived in Saudi Arabia. And I saw her like a couple decades later, and we were having a conversation, and we somehow were getting into politics, and she talked about how communism is a good idea in theory. And I was like, no, it's not. I was like, it's a terrible idea in theory, and it's even worse in reality. And she was like, well, why is it a bad idea in theory, right? Everyone gets this. And I was like, okay, let's imagine something. Let's imagine that you're a university graduate, right? She was like, yeah, I've got my degree. I was like, okay, imagine if you went to university or even in school and in all the classes you were in, imagine if no matter how hard you worked, everybody got the same grade. Would that be fair? And she was like, no, of course not. I was like, there you go. Like you could sort of see the penny drop in her brain. And I was like, and if you had that system, what do you think would happen? Do you think people would keep working hard? And she's like, no, why would I work hard if I'm going to get the same grade regardless? I was like, there you go. Now scale that up to a society. And that's why even in theory, it's not a good idea. Cause I find too many conservatives do the, oh, well, it's a good idea in theory, but bad in practice. I'm like, no, don't even give them theory, cause it's crap in theory.
There's actually, I think someone wrote there is a famous experiment where a teacher did that over like 6 months in a class, and where she took everybody's scores on a regular basis and she just averaged them. Mm. And what happened, the average just kept dropping. So the average started out at a B, and then everyone realized that they were just being averaged. So they didn't try. So basically incrementally, it just basically just dropped the average from a B to a C to a D to an E to an F, basically until everybody was consistently failing. And this touches on a very interesting point about average and excellence, which I want to touch on. But before I touch on that, I just want to say something to your point earlier about conservatism and just common sense and the stuff that just works. So there's this idea of like this, the study of matter versus the study of what matters, right? And the study of matter is like physics, metallurgy, engineering, right? Like it's you're taking stuff and manipulating it and you're working with it, right? And the study of matter is very it's very empirical. It's very progressive in the sense that you are always compounding on the information. You discover new things, and then you're using the new things that you discover to discover something else, etc. And you create these exponential effects. That's why technology is such a force multiplier. Like it builds on itself, and it grows very quickly. But the study of what matters, that's things like philosophy and principles and ideas and all this sort of stuff, it doesn't work the same way. There's like principles that work are timeless. Mm-hmm. And they're timeless insofar as human beings and our biology and our DNA and who we are is also effectively timeless. It doesn't change. Like things might evolve over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, but that's the rate at which principles arguably evolve, if mm-hmm. at all. And the big problem we've got in modern society is that and you know, this is sort of giving the benefit of the doubt to people who have a progressive mind, is that they project the same mentality or the same paradigm onto the thing, like the study of what matters from the study of matter, right? They're like, oh, you know, if we can just deconstruct everything, and if we can just like, you know, forget about like, you know, this piece here, marriage, who needs that? Oh, gender roles, whatever, you know, who cares? Like two genders, who needs that? Like, they look at these things in isolation, outside of the gestalt, right? Outside of the whole, and look at it almost atomically. It's like, okay, let's just put some atoms together, create a new molecule, and then we have a new piece of tech, and this is new social tech or new civilizational tech. But the problem is, it just doesn't work that way. Like, you remove these fundamental things, and it's more like you've got a structure that's sitting there, and you're down at the bottom pulling out the bricks of the foundation and being like, oh yeah, screw it, we don't need this one, we don't need that one. And then you wonder why the whole thing starts to fall apart, right? So this is a really, 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 like, for the people listening to this, it's the study of matter and the study of what matters operate on different principles. They're completely different paradigms. Mixing the two together is a bad idea. Like, if you go and take, and it actually applies the other way around. Like, if you try to build something, like, technologically speaking, and you just keep doing the same thing over and over again, like, because this principle works, like, guess what? You're not going to discover anything new, right? We're not going to have Newtons or Teslas or these people. So it's like, you actually fundamentally have to think different, and you want to be careful not to conflate the modality of both. And to me, that's extremely important.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. What I find is a lot of people are just not good at connecting dots, and a lot of people do not practice second, third, let alone fourth order thinking. So as you said, they want to knock down a domino, and they have no perception or concept or insight into, well, what else is connected to that domino? Is that thing part of a chain? Or, I mean, someone might see a skyscraper. Like, if you had no idea about construction or architecture, maybe you're a child and you see like support beams, you might be like, what's that beam doing? It might be in the middle of a building, right? It could be like a sort of a church or a cathedral or something, and you've got these like massive pillars, and you're like, that pillar's in the way, it's blocking my view. Like, what, why do we need this pillar, right? Like, let's just knock this out. And they don't have the thought of, okay, well, you knock this out here, and then you knock that out there, and then later down the line it starts to wobble and the entire structure could fall because you take out the foundation, you take out the root. And, you know, when you talk about family, when you talk about faith, when you talk about certain virtues and values within a society, these are the glue and the structure that hold it all together. And, you know, one of my favorite authors is C.S. Lewis, and he has a great term where he uses, he calls it chronological snobbery, right? Which is this idea that in any given time, people assume that they're so much smarter and so much more advanced than all of the people who came before them, right? So as people say, oh, it's 2024, Alex. So we can just sort of throw all that stuff away. As you said, oh, two genders, right? Oh, that's backwards. That's old. That's what they thought 1,000 years ago. Like, we're so much more advanced. We're so much more enlightened. And so people end up doing really, really foolish things and holding really foolish beliefs because they have the idea that new equals good and old equals bad, which is, you know, the world is not that simple.
Yeah, I love that term, chronological snobbery. It's so true. And it always makes me laugh because the kind of people who have the highest chronological snobbery, in my opinion, are the ones who think they're most accepting and, you know, open and all this sort of stuff. But in fact, like, the way they live, forget what they say, right? It's like what they do is arrogant. It's like, yeah, like the last how many thousands of years of like human living and experimentation is worth nothing. But my deconstruction of gender theory or whatever the hell I'm doing in my university course is somehow like I discovered the truth. No worries, bro. Mm-hmm. You're 19 years old. You've dyed your hair purple and you're a genius all of a sudden. Thank you.
Like, yep. You got it all so worked dumb. Out. Yeah. So let's talk about your book, man, the Bushido of Bitcoin. What made you want to write it?
So the journey is interesting. Have you met Eric Kaysen yet? Sort of out of the
No, I haven't.
Space?
I don't think so.
He's one of my favorite Bitcoiners, like super passionate guy, really, 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 really profoundly well-read. Probably one of the most well-read people I know, at least in the top 10. And he and I did a podcast in 2022 called The Bushido of Bitcoin. And we called it that because we were discussing Japanese history, the samurai, and in particular a book called Shogun, which a lot more people have heard of today because the show recently came out. But it's a book written by an author called James Clavell, and it's historic fiction. It goes through a period of Japanese history around the Battle of Sekigahara, which is where the real character, Tokugawa Ieyasu, he was the guy who reunited Japan during the Warring States period. And the book itself changes the names a little bit and uses some fictional characters, but basically is historically accurate. And I read that book, or more accurately, listened to it right during the middle of the COVID hysteria. I was locked down in Germany, and the book is so well written. I swear to God, it's like incredible. You listen to it, particularly the Audible is just so well written and well read. It just transports you back in time. And you can imagine me, like, I'm here listening to this book. It's 50 hours, and I'm like, I'm transported back to 1600s Japan, and there's like, you know, things like honor, and, you know, when a daimyo disagrees with his lord, or a samurai disagrees with his lord, he literally like disembowels himself, like through the ritual act of seppuku, like just wild, insane stuff. And it talks about how the Portuguese brought Christianity there through the Jesuits and all this sort of stuff. Like, and it's just this brutal, masculine, powerful, beautiful period of human history. And then I go outside and there's people wearing masks on the street. And I was like, God, what have you, like, why have you forsaken me? You know what I mean? Like, what am I doing in this era? Like, it was insane. And that book, it was etched into my psyche at the time. And it led me down a path of just getting in touch with history again, feudal history, medieval history, ancient history. And I'm of Macedonian descent. And when I was young, like, the first early books that I read were books about Alexander the Great, like Plutarch's history and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm talking like an 8-9-year-old kid. I didn't know what I was reading, but like, I was fascinated by these greats. And I guess 2022 rolls around. We published on Communist Manifesto. You know, I'm still seeing madness around the world, all the stuff that happened with the elections, all this sort of stuff. And I also had a bit of a disillusionment period with not Bitcoin, but the Bitcoin community, and specifically just seeing people who I thought had like a level of character and virtue just behave very differently. So the question hit me. I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure that economically speaking, Bitcoin's going to win. There's almost no doubt in my mind about that. And if it does, what happens then? And you've seen the trailer that I made for the book. Like, I asked this question in the trailer, right? Thank you. The question that hit me was, okay, if we win, or more likely when Bitcoin wins, who do we become? Do we just become another parasitical class because we've got all the economic power? Do we become just a bunch of degenerates? Like, and funny enough, a lot of early Bitcoiners who came, got a lot of money, became either shitcoiners, they became gamblers, they became degenerates, all this sort of stuff. So do we become that, or do we become men and women of virtue? And it's not enough just to say, oh yeah, Bitcoin fixes this, which is a lot of like, it's like a weak argument that a lot of people have. We have to actually establish a new culture. So from that came the question, okay, it's like, okay, what kind of culture do we need to establish? What do we need? And I looked at, if culture is upstream of civilization, right, and culture is upstream of politics, what is upstream of culture? And what's upstream of culture is virtues and principles, essentially. Like, you can think of virtues as almost like a blend of principles and behavior. If you could merge the two words together of principles and behavior, that's the definition of virtue. Virtue is an act. Values are something that you desire, but a virtue is an act. Virtue is how you attain the value, attain the thing that you value. So if like freedom is a value, responsibility is the virtue that leads to freedom. So that people have this sort of in their head. So with that established, okay, so it's the virtues that matter. I said, what are the virtues that we should look for? And I thought, well, you know, instead of trying to recreate it like some, you know, leftoid empiricist and say, okay, let me just pull out these new atoms, I looked at the past, because there has obviously been civilizations that have been built that still form the foundation upon which we walk today, right? And what I found was extremely, extremely, extremely fascinating is the great civilizations, whether it was the Eastern, like the Japanese, whether it was the Christendom of the West, whether it was the Romans, whether it was the Greeks and the Macedonians, all of these cultures seemed to emerge out of a warrior class who established a key set of virtues that the rest of civilization then embodied and lived by to a large degree. And it's really important that it came from the warrior class, because the warrior class is almost like the beacon of civilization. They were the protectors of the lower class. So the lower classes were inspired by them, and they were the defenders of the upper classes. So the upper classes were dependent on them. So it was like they were this sort of beacon, this special set of characters, and they had the power of life and death over both of them, right? But the great warrior classes established sets of virtues that they lived by in order to maintain not just a level of, oh, okay, this guy can beat me up, but a level of awe and inspiration that people wanted to emulate. So it was very important that class was the one that established these things. But to kind of finish my train of thought here is, the great civilizations all had cultures which had virtues that, lo and behold, were similar. And so similar, in fact, like you had Bushido as a concept in Japan that was almost identical to chivalry as a concept in Europe, which, funny enough, came about at the exact same time in completely disconnected cultures. The Japanese had no contact with the West. The West had no contact with Japan. And they literally had the same virtues. That concept, that idea became the seed for the book and the namesake of the book, Bushido of Bitcoin. So the word Bushido means way of the warrior, right? So it was in Japan, what that meant was you could be a samurai or you could be a bushi. So samurai was something more hereditary, but a bushi was a man of war or a warrior in the truest sense of the term, which is someone who embodied a moral code or a code of virtue, much like the great knights were the ones who embodied the code that was implied by chivalry, right? And that basically, as I said, formed the seeds of the book. So this isn't really a book about Bitcoin. Like the word Bitcoin is used in there to represent the term socioeconomic paradigm. Because like we're going into a new socioeconomic paradigm, like first of all, because the current paradigm just can't last. You can't build a functional, long-lasting paradigm on lies and fiat money and, you know, modern large-scale nation-state globalism and all this sort of stuff. These are lies. They're broken socioeconomic paradigms. So it's going to fall apart. And in my opinion, the basis for the next socioeconomic paradigm is going to be something that is sound, incorruptible, uncheatable, and all that sort of stuff, right? Which is where Bitcoin sits in. So the idea is that if that's the socioeconomic paradigm that we're moving into, what are then the virtues? What is the code that we should seek to establish or entwine in the DNA of the new culture that we want to build? And like I said, it's not going to be a new set of virtues that we conjure up out of thin air. It is going to be something that we know has worked in the past that has a healthy tension. And we'll talk about this later, but like, you know, there needs to be justice and compassion, right? You can't just have pure justice because then you become Nazis, right? So it's like you need to have compassion as well to balance these things. And that's what all of the great codes had, whether it was chivalry, whether it was the way the Romans behaved, whether it was Bushido and all this sort of stuff. So I'll shut up there, but that's basically an overview. Like it started off as like a historical view of like the relationship between Japanese Bushido and Bitcoin, but it evolved into something so much broader. And the book is now a playbook for a world on a new socioeconomic standard.
Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, I don't know if you're like me, but I find that the older I get, the more interested I become in history. So when I was in school, to me, history was one of the boring subjects. I liked math. I liked science. I liked a range of different subjects. But history was one of those ones where I was just like, why am I learning about just all this stuff that happened hundreds of years ago? And I think I now understand why I and many other kids find history boring. And I think it's largely because of how it's taught. I think that we learn the when and the what, but we don't learn the why and the how. So it's never even explained to you, why are we learning this, right? So as you get older, you realize, okay, it's important to understand history because to understand our current moment, that's based on a series of historical events that has led to where we are now in whatever nation or place you might be in. My family's originally from Nigeria. You've got a Macedonian background, right? Okay, in Nigeria, like, wait, why do people here even speak English? It's like, oh, because it was colonized by England and then they gained independence, right? Like, even the languages that people speak are based on history. So when it's actually framed that way, and when you understand that human nature just really doesn't fundamentally change over the millennia, and the advantages we have as modern people are simply better technology and access to history, then we can use these lessons from all of these billions of people who have come before us, the good things that they did and the bad things that they did. And we can be, there are certain things we can be like, okay, how do we know this is a bad idea? We know this is a bad idea because it was tried before and it resulted in hundreds of millions of deaths, for example, right? Or we know this is a good idea because it's persisted through thousands of years and it's pro-social. And in all of these different countries, it benefits. If you're someone who's even into stats and data and studies, you can literally look at data and studies and things, right? So for someone who's there questioning, is it better for a child to be raised with a father and a mother or not? You've got people who literally debate this point. It's like, okay, you can pull out studies showing, oh, okay, absent father, what is it? Like 10 times more chance of going to prison, like multiple times more chance of ending up on drugs or depressed or incarcerated, lower grades, lower earnings, teenage pregnancy, whatever, any negative outcome that exists goes up if a father is not present across a general population. And any sane society would be like, oh, okay, so yeah, this does matter. And this is something that we should do our best to maintain as a standard. But we're living in this super goofy clown world where no matter the issue, people want to debate everything. As you've said before, people literally want to debate, like, do men and women even exist? Do we even need, not even what should the roles be, right? It's not even a question of like, is this even a binary category? And it's just like, guys, this has been worked out since before they knew what science was. They had worked this out. So who are we? It's such a waste of time and energy. And there's so many incredibly intelligent people. I'll be honest with you, Alex. Sometimes sometimes I myself get frustrated when I find myself talking about this issue. But the thing is, something that's very insidious about clown world, in my opinion, is that you can't ignore it, right? You have to talk about it. So as much as I might be tired of explaining to someone for the 500th time why it doesn't make sense to have biological males compete with biological with women in sports, or to allow them in female prisons, or to whatever the case may be, I'm so tired of that issue. But it's like, if you just ignore it and pretend it's not happening, then that's how it gets to where it's gotten. So you have to push back against it. But then what happens is it sucks up so much time and energy and resources, and you have all of this, these smart people who are just wasting all of this time. And I think that's actually like the most insidious thing. It's like it's you can't ignore it, but if you engage in it, you get sucked into this vortex, and it seems like a massive waste of time and energy. But at the same time, you have to fight the fight, even if it seems like a stupid one.
You do. And I guess that's just maybe that's just the function of the period we're in, because we let it get so bad. And this is one of the things, once again, to tie it back to what we said earlier about the libertarianism, is like the whole libertarian narrative of, just let people do whatever they want if it doesn't affect me. Right. That's actually what got us here in the first place. It's like, oh, let them do it. And it's like all of a sudden there's trannies everywhere. And it's like, well, OK. Now people like you and I have to get out there, and now we have to waste our time telling people that there's two genders and that it's, all the things that you just mentioned. So it kind of like, it actually reinforces the necessity for having strong borders, metaphorically and literally speaking, right? Is that if you don't have that baseline to say, no, this is the line, and sorry, we're not crossing that line. And it may seem intolerant, it might seem mean, it might seem, hurtful and all that sort of stuff. But like, as once again, as we get older, we realize that love sometimes has to be tough. You just can't be nice and cushiony and cuddly and all this sort of stuff. Because what you do is you soften the person you're being nice to. That happens with kids, and it literally happens with society. And that's what's happened. We've made everybody so soft and cushy and fat and lazy and, entitled and all this sort of stuff. And we're wondering now why we have to, kind of slap them awake. And it always reminds me of the movie WALL-E, right? Like, that was a documentary, basically. It literally was. It was the best Disney film ever made. And I don't know if they consciously or unconsciously made it based, but like, it literally is. It shows you what happens when you make comfort the thing. And, but... Yeah, to your point, like
it's an imbalance. Right, yeah, for sure, man. I think it's a massive imbalance of feminine and masculine energy, and totally. I don't even use those terms, that energy, because energy can always sound a little bit woo woo, but that's what it is. It's almost like in the West, in the modern West, at scale, we're basically suffering with a sort of toxic femininity. And when I say that, I don't even mean that. I'm not even specifically referring to females necessarily doing and implementing some of these things. Just the, there is such a thing as toxic compassion, and there is such a thing as toxic empathy. And again, if you exist in the real world and you've seen good fathers and good mothers operate, they don't have the exact same job, right? There is some overlap, but typically the mother is going to be far more protective, more anxious, more nurturing, more caring, more compassionate, more willing to provide and protect. And they don't want their child to experience any potential danger, whereas the dad is more likely to be roughhousing and to push the son or daughter to challenge themselves physically and to try this. And okay, cool. Yeah, you might get hurt, but you know what? Get up, dust yourself off, and so on. And so you need that balance. And I think what's happening just at scale across everything, across the families, across governments, across society, across politics, even within some of the churches, is it's all being overly feminized, right? The masculine has been demonized so much, and those principles and virtues that are more masculine have been demonized. And now there's just this imbalance, and it's all about niceness and inclusion and softness and never making anybody feel bad. And, no more competition. Everything has to be cooperative, and we can't, it's all got to be equal.
Exactly.
But not equal in the real sense, not equal in the complementary sense, but equal in the sense of everyone is the same, we're all just genderless blobs, and we're all they thems.
Man, it's you hit on honestly one of my favorite topics. Me and Peter McCormick were basically arguing about this because he was trying to make the opposite case. And I was like, no. Leadership, governance, things like this are masculine traits.
Yes.
Like so when you dance, there's a reason why the male leads and the female follows. It's not that the female is less useful. Like if a man doesn't have the female, then what's he going to lead? Himself? No, he's going to be looking like a dork on the dance floor, right? So you need both, and fundamentally each plays a different role. And you touch on such a good point. And this is where, you know, I go back to the French Revolution. I discussed this a little bit in the book, is that if you want to look at when the inversion of the masculine frame and leadership started to occur, it was at the point of the French Revolution. That was like a genesis point for the West, where that started to invert. And it was inverted literally and metaphorically speaking. So the little father, which was the identity of the king, he was always known as the little father, particularly Louis XVI, right? Louis XIV, if you go back a couple of generations, he was the strong masculine king. I always say that, like, if Louis XIV was alive when Louis XVI's head got chopped off, there wouldn't have been a French Revolution. We'd have no wokeness now. Communism wouldn't have existed. Like, people don't realize that communism, like, proto-communism was during the French Revolution, the Jacobins, the original left came from there. And that idea is what inspired Marx 80, 100 years later to create communism, because he's like, oh, the French fucked up, so we need to do it right now. But what happened during the French Revolution was the first time things that worked for millennia were overturned. So it was the first time women were given the vote. That was when, you know, suffrage started to come in, and the responsibility of voting went on to women, and it pulled them out of the household. They made divorce legal for the first time. They stripped the father of his power inside the house. So they stripped the father of his power inside the society as the king, and they literally beheaded the king, removed him, and they created a committee of equal rights holders, which turned into the terror, the Great Terror, and they all killed each other in the French during the French Revolution. But they did all of this sort of stuff that was really, really insidious, and it overturned the functional patriarchy that existed, the functional order that existed, and slowly these the feminization of the West, the equalization, the democratization of the West started to occur step by step. It was like very, 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 I should say, it was, the effect was subtle because the attempt was very brazen, obviously. Like, all of this stuff happened, and then it kind of knee-jerked back out. Like, no one expected Napoleon. Napoleon kind of brought structure and order and masculinity back, and then we all know what happened. He got exiled, and then, you know, the sort of the West started step by step over the next couple of generations to go further down. Like, the next thing you've got is World War One. What happened in World War One? All the strong, young, vital, energetic men got wiped out, and then for good measure, World War Two happens to kill off the last of them, and then you had a whole generation of people raised by mothers who, to give them the benefit of the doubt, of course, they had nothing, they had no other option, and they did the best they could with what they had. But you had entire generations of boomers raised without strong men, without strong fathers, and then you had the age of the 60s, the hippies and the free love and all this sort of stuff. Let's just throw all of the other values out the window. And slowly by slowly, you look at from the French Revolution up until now, things have been feminized. And the feminine is fundamentally more left-oriented. It is more compassion-oriented. It is more equal-oriented, as you said. And that's not to say that we should eliminate that. No, like, it's not a bad thing, but it needs to exist within a framework. And a framework, by the definition of the word, a frame implies borders. Like, borders, frame, masculine, necessary to exist in order to have order. Without it, you just have this, as you said, a blob. And that's what we've become.
Yeah, man.
One of my favorite topics, bro, honestly.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly interesting. And what's funny is, because of the overt overcorrection of political correctness that we've been living through for most of our lives is even talking about this issue like upsets a lot of people. And so many people dodge this issue because, you know, another one of the sort of stupid paradigms of the time is that we live in this age where people think that if something isn't all the one way, then it's all the way the other way. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I say something like, yeah, a child should have a mother and a father, people will be like, oh, so you hate single mothers, or you're saying that everyone who was raised. I'm like, wait,
when did I say?
Oh, so you don't think women should be allowed to vote? It's like, did I say that? Like, can you find me any podcast, or I've got 100,000 tweets out there. Can you find me the one where I said that? It's just like, I don't know. There's just an imbalance. It's just an imbalance. And it's at such a scale now that it's just messing everything up. That's the reality of it. And I think the thing I find most frustrating, one of the things I find really frustrating about our times and our nations as well, right? I'm from the UK. I know you're from Australia. You could talk about Canada. You could talk about the US, lots of Western European countries. Is it's taken so long for these countries to get as good as they are and to actually get the true freedoms and rights and a basic level of safety and functionality. Again, you study history and you see how horribly most people have lived throughout history, and you travel the world and you see how badly most people live. I mean, for listeners, I mean, if you're curious, if you earn over about $30,000 a year in terms of income, you're in the top 1% globally. About $30,000 a year puts you in the top 1% globally. Yes, I know that places have different living costs, but that should give people some sort of perspective as to just how well off we are in Western developed countries. And it's so frustrating for me to see them disintegrating from within when it's like, guys, do you realize how much blood, sweat, and tears it took to get to this stage? And now you want to take these stupid ideas that you learned in your college class and you want to just and you want to just ruin it all in your trying to create your weird utopia, instead of just going, okay, you know what, like, why don't we just take a pause, have some appreciation, keep the things that are working really well. You know what, there are some things that do need change, right? There are some things that do need to actually be perhaps torn down and built back up, or very radically shifted, right? The money system, that's a great one to start with. Okay, we could be like, you know what, actually the system they had 100 years ago was better than it is now. The system they had 2000 years ago was better than it is now, because at least they were on a gold standard. So how about we radically change that? How about we look at the public education system and see that it's not producing the results that it should be? And it's like, all right, you know what, you want to change something? How about we radically change that? How about we don't just abolish the police and like get rid of laws and abolish the family and try to destroy the church and Christianity with it, and just sort of all these things that we need and that are so vital to Western civilization. It's like, instead of attacking those ones, why can't the approach just be something sensible? And I don't know, it frustrates me, but at the same time, I am optimistic. I think we're at a state, I think we had the great sleepening, especially the last few years. And I think we're in the early stages of some type of awakening. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but if I look at where we are now compared to where we were, let's say July 2020, I think the world is looking pretty different.
Very much so. I mean, two things you remind me of there. Number one is I'm sure you've seen the clip, you're in Dubai, of that, like that montage of Dubai from 1980 to 2023. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's like basically a desert patch and it becomes this like metropolis. And I haven't done this tweet. I'm going to have to do it at some point and just like piss people off. But basically I was going to do a montage of like San Francisco over the last 45 years and Dubai over the last 45 years. And just like say patriarchy, liberal democracy. And just like, what's the outcome? So like literally San Francisco went from like one of the greatest cities in the history of humanity, like the, you know, the tech hub, all this sort of stuff, like innovation, everything. And now it's turned into a place where it's like junkies and poop on the floor everywhere. And like literal signs on the street that say the maximum you can steal is $950. If you don't, like, it's insane. Mm-hmm. And that was under liberal democratic principles versus a patriarchy. And it drives me crazy. Like, there's so many of these, like, you know, leftists who will get up and say, oh, but Dubai is a slave dictatorship. It's like,
oh, I hear it all. Trust me. I live here.
It drives me insane. It's like, yeah, they're just so seething that something works, like that they'll throw whatever crap they can on it. But Dubai, literally in the same time, under what is effectively a family monarchy or a patriarchy, literally mm-hmm. built a metropolis in the middle of the desert. And, you know, people go, oh, it's all oil money. It's like, no, people don't realize that Dubai is not oil money. Like, sure, there is some oil money.
5%.
Exactly. It's like it's a fraction of where their real money, and it's innovation, it's drive, it's vision, it's structure, it's order. It is extremely actually masculine. That the mm-hmm. the place is that. And if that's not a sign, I don't know what is. I don't know how else to like sort of to describe it. So anyway, that was one thing that came to mind when you're describing all of this. The second thing came to mind, have you seen that clip from Chris Walken where he talks about the lion? Like, he's in the change room and he's like, you know, you've got this lion and mm-hmm. he's sleeping, and you know, the cubs come and nip at his ankles, and you know, he's like, he's sleeping and he ignores them, and you know, his wife comes and like messes with him, and then you know, the other animals notice that. So then the hyenas, they start getting closer, and then they start yelling and this and that, and then they get a little bit closer and they start like nipping at his heels, and these you know, the hyenas and everything is like they confuse the lion's tolerance and patience for weakness, and mm-hmm. one moment the lion gets up and he runs like the wind and he tears them all apart, right? So it's like I almost envision Western man or the Western spirit, right? Which is probably more accurate, like the spirit of what built the West. It's been like that lion sleeping dormant. Like I love what you said, the great sleepening, because that's essentially what it's been. And now it's like the jackals and the hyenas have like taken us for granted. It's like the true definition of like the weak and the ugly, which is these parasites who don't produce anything, who just like suck from civilization. Their biggest fear is people like you, people like me, people like Trump, Bukele, whatever, like these people rising up and actually channeling power. Families having kids, building their own communities, having wealth. That is what freaks them out the most. And honestly, Western man has been sleeping, the Western spirit has been sleeping for a while now. But as you said, like I can sense a big shift. And for me, like, one of the shifts was obviously Elon taking back Twitter. But for me, like a big watershed moment was at the end of last year when Milei won. Mm. That was unexpected. And honestly, I just felt like a big energetic shift. And again, without sounding like, ooh, I'm a hippie, you know, I had my crystals and stuff. Like, no, like I'll
tell you how real that is, because I was in El Salvador. I was invited to Bukele's inauguration. So I was there a matter of weeks ago. And Milei was there as well. Mm-hmm, and the energy was palpable, Alex, man. It wasn't, it's one thing seeing things on social media and watching videos. It's another one being there in the crowd. And dude, like even when, like a lot of world leaders were there, presidents of Ecuador, Costa Rica, Kosovo, like all sorts of places. When Milei came, freaking roar, man. Like people were so hyped to see him. And then like when Bukele and his wife came, it was just, I've never been to a country, maybe the second closest is UAE actually, but a country where people genuinely love the leader so much. From the Uber drivers to the people working in the barbershop to the ladies running their stalls in the market, just everybody, you know, you hear, oh yeah, 90% approval rating, and you might think, is that real or whatever? And then you go to the country and you're like,
it actually is. Yeah.
You're like, this is,
I've been many times, and it's a different feeling, man. And that matters so much. And it's like that's the difference between leadership and management, right? Like, so modern governance has become management. It's like middle managers. It's like, imagine, you know, that annoying micromanager at work who just like sits here behind your head watching you like, oh, what are you doing? You know, are you typing? Have you sent that email? It's like, get away from me. Like that doesn't like create a space for somebody to grow and be themselves. Whereas leadership is about leading from the front, setting an example, living by a code, by virtues, by principles, and then inspiring others to follow and do the same. Like, that's a beautiful thing. And that's a big part of what we've lost. We've like turned the world, like I wrote a long tweet a couple weeks ago, which said the world has basically become like a mix of a nursing home and a children's playpen. Like, we've simultaneously, like, you know, the boomers, like, have, particularly in Europe, you know what I mean? Like, dude, I was driving a car. Like, I hate hiring cars these days because, like, every single car has so many safety buttons and safety beepers and everything like that. Like, you know, it sounds like you're driving in a circus, basically, because, like, you're reversing, like, beep, 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 beep. It's like, Jesus Christ, there's nothing there. Like, you know, the car's 6 feet away and it's starting to beep at you. It's like, oh, you're driving on a highway and there's nobody around, so you change the lane without using the blinker or the indicator, and it's like the thing, like, pulls your steering wheel back. Yes, like, you're gonna have an accident. It's like, what are you doing? Like, it drives me crazy, right? But that's a function of, like, transforming society into this, like, basically a HR department. That's what we're living in. We're living in one big giant HR department where everything is about safety
and safetyism.
Exactly, complete safetyism. And that is antithetical to growth. Like, if you're going to grow, if you're going to expand, you're going to have to be in a dangerous situation. You like, there's no way around it. Like, if you want to build fake muscle, go and inject yourself with, you know, whatever, like the Synthol.
Yeah.
If you want to build actual muscle, you have to get underneath the barbell. You have to pick something up. You have to push against pressure, push against danger. Like, that's why things like, I always tell people, like, if you're a male, don't just go to the gym as well. Like, go and actually fight. Go get on the mats, go and get punched in the face, do something like that, because that's going to ignite something inside of you. Like, you know, I'm going off on all sorts of tangents here, but one thing here is, like, the testosterone thing drives me crazy. You know, you got all these, like, biohackers and everything. But, oh, it's the plastics. It's this and that. It's like, bro, do you know what the testosterone problem is? You're not getting punched in the face. You're sitting there on a keyboard typing, and your life is like typing on a keyboard in an office. You do not need testosterone to type on a keyboard in an office. You know, testosterone is an on-demand hormone. Like,
lifestyle.
For your body to produce it, you need a reason to produce it. And arguing with somebody on Twitter is not a reason to produce it. Like, like, it literally is not. Like, Reddit is not a reason to produce testosterone. Like, we have a testosterone problem in the world today because men are not pressured. We live in a cushion. We live in basically a giant condom. Like, if you really want to know what the world is, it's a giant condom designed for safety. And that is the wrong way to live. That is how you emasculate everybody. And what you do is, as you emasculate men, you masculate women. And we come closer and closer and closer and closer together until we're all this like androgynous blob, as we were discussing earlier, where there's no such thing as men, there's no such thing as women, and we're all the same. And then there's no polarity. And when there's no polarity, there's no charge. And when there's no charge, there's no life, there's no energy. Like,
and there's no attraction.
There's no attraction. Exactly. You cannot have attraction without a charge. You need opposite poles in order to have that. And this is like literally, you know, these concepts all come together. Average, equality, all this sort of stuff lives in the realm of sameness. It lives in the realm of a blob. You know, like, the last analogy I'll give, and then I'll shut up, is if you get a color palette of like red, blue, green, orange, all these beautiful colors, and if you want to make them equal, do you know what you do? You mix them all together and you just make gray. Like, and that's what's happening. Like, that's globalism. That's like average. That's equality for you. Like, if you want to turn everything into nothingness, you make it all gray. And that's what's happening with the world. And we need to lean the complete opposite way. And that might mean in the short term, we need to be a little bit more extreme, but we need to like shift the Overton window back, because the Overton window has been shifting to like complete insanity for so long now. We need to yank it back in the other direction, back to sanity, back to reality, back to life, back to vitality, back to strength, back to beauty, all of these things. So, rant over.
Dude, you nailed it, man. And that's a beautiful way. I feel you, man. I spend so much time thinking about these ideas. So it's interesting I love talking to people who get it, for lack of a better term, people who get it and who can connect these dots and see that we're not all disembodied and atomized, and you can see how economics and family and faith and history and tradition and culture and media. They're all connected. Mm-hmm. They're all intertwined, right? People see these as totally different silos. And I'm like, no, they're not silos. Sometimes people ask me, Zubi, why do you talk about this thing? Because they think it's disconnected. I'm like, no, it's not. It's not disconnected, right? I have tweets multiple times. I've tweeted it. And every time it goes viral, I'm like, the whole world or like the whole nation, if everybody lift, I'll be like, look, if everybody lifted weights, you mm-hmm. don't understand how, right? If everybody strength trained, if every single adult in, say, America lifted weights, you have no idea how many problems that would solve. And people are like, what are you even talking about? Yeah. What does lifting weights have to do with the economy, have to do with the family, have to do with culture? I'm like, a lot, right? People don't connect the dots with Bitcoin, right? They don't understand how the money system itself impacts other things. They just think the economy is this little bubble. You remember in 2020, right? Do we save lives or do we save the economy, right? Like your sacrifice. It's like, guys, what is this weird binary, right? Like, do you know what the economy is? It's not a stock market ticker. The people are the economy. It's you. It's your labor. It's your trading. It's your goods. Like, if no one is doing anything, then, and if the economy goes to crap, then people's health also goes to crap, and you get more deaths, and you get more deaths. Like, they're not disconnected. But yeah, man, dude, we can go for a really long time. But where can people find you? And most importantly, where can people get the book, Alex?
Thank you, bro. People can find me mostly on Twitter, and I just reactivated my Instagram. And if they type in Svetsky Writes, so like writing, WRITES, and my surname is Svetsky, SVETSKI. The book can be found at bushidoofbitcoin.com. And I guess by the time they're listening to this, they'll be able to pick it up on Amazon. I'll have a link on the website that'll take you to the Amazon, and there'll be an option to obviously purchase it for Bitcoin. But yeah, that's probably the two main places. On Twitter, I do my rants and I kind of talk about the nexus between business, Bitcoin, and economics, and kind of like this, I don't know what to call it, the new ascendant, right? Like in the book, I talk about this concept of Christo-Hopper Nietzscheanism. So it's kind of like Christianity is the base, Hopper as like the example of Austrian economics, like, you know, the idea of like private property, and he's my favorite Austrian economist. And Nietzscheanism is this idea of like vitality, strength, and beauty. Like somewhere in that Venn diagram is what I think the energy of the new West is. And you know, people like you, for example, you get that instinctually. Like, I don't need to explain that to you, but I hope that sort of framework helps people to find resources and discover stuff. So, yeah, that's mainly what I yell about on Twitter and on Instagram. I'm doing more educational stuff and all other places, but yeah, they're the two primary places.
Awesome, Alex. Thanks for coming on the show, man. Always love talking to you.
Zubi, thank you, brother. Appreciate it.